All right. How are you today? My name is Rami. I'm here with Richard Campbell.
Howdy.
Richard Campbell is the awesome founder of .NET Rocks.
I am not the founder of .NET Rocks.
Not the founder, but no. The main person, I think.
I am the co-host. So the show started back in 2002 with my friend Carl Franklin, who, I mean, the amazing thing about that is the word podcast wouldn't exist till 2004. So he was just putting internet MP3 files on the internet. I was a guest. I was actually in Montreal at Jean-René Waugh's conference, DevTeach, when Carl and I met. And then I came on as co-host on episode 100, and we are now at 1,227, I think.
Wow.
So it's been 10 years.
10 years.
Yeah.
It feels like you've been co-hosting it for so long that I just like assume that you're the guy who started it.
And
you definitely started. Well, anyway, you've definitely been co-hosting it longer than I've been coding.
Well, and that's one of the things that's been happening to us on .NET Rocks now is folks that got into software, you know, 8-9 years ago and heard .NET Rocks back then and sort of made a goal, someday I want to be on that show, and now they're on the show. So it happens on a period, every so often we get to have some guys say, well, I get to cross this off my bucket list. I got on .NET Rocks. I'd say it's been a lot of fun.
That's awesome. We've obviously, I obviously love your podcast.
Well, thanks.
And there's been a couple of really interesting ones, you know, about AI and a couple of other things that have really caught my attention.
The geek outs.
I absolutely love the geek outs. Now, as a developer yourself, what inspires you?
Well, I've been writing software now for almost 40 years.
Wow.
And so I feel like I don't have a lot to prove on the keyboard anymore in the terms of writing code. What gets me really excited these days is the ability to help others be more effective. You know, I've had a chance to lead a bunch of teams and to build some great things over the years. And yeah, I can write code. I still solve problems myself. But you talk about what gets me up in the morning, what gets me really excited, it's like, how am I going to get this team to move the ball forward, to get them to reach their goals? You know, I'm a pretty satisfied guy. I've had a good run. You know, I've been doing this for a long time. And yeah, if you can't bring folks with you, you really aren't going to have much.
That's awesome. And I definitely agree with you. Teaching people how to code is becoming more and more important.
Absolutely.
Any tips that you've learned? Like, how do you approach this?
You can't type and teach.
I agree with
that. Right? So I think a big piece of that is actually there is no simple way to turn the switch in someone's head other than to help them do it. Right? And we all had that moment. Right? I mean, everybody here, we are developers. You had that moment where the instructions led to an action you expected. You had a moment where you related to the machine in a different way. Getting someone to that moment, super rewarding, but it's a time thing. There's no way around helping someone working through that until they finally realize those instructions resulted in this behavior and they start to see that flow. So, you've just got to put the time in, put the keyboard in front of the person and let them learn, let them have that moment.
Have you seen any projects that have inspired you to work harder? Have inspired you.
How's that going?
It's beautiful sound.
You got great taste in ringtone, so I'll give you that.
It's still going.
Yeah.
It's still going.
Yay! Woo! What was your question?
Sorry. Have you seen any library or tool or program that has really helped you inspire the next generation of programmers? Something that stands out?
I mean, there's a lot of software out there. It's hard to pick any one, right? And I don't necessarily, you know, I work on a bunch of projects that people get pretty excited about. I don't necessarily want to pick my own. But, you know, Humanitarian Toolbox was an initiative to build software to help disaster relief organizations, right, in an open source way. And just the ideas that sort of came in as we started organizing that and talking to the NGOs and realizing, you know, we live in this funny little bubble, us tech people. Yeah. We all have smartphones. We know what the cloud does. We understand peer-to-peer networking. Do you understand the vast majority of the world has no idea what that is?
Yeah.
It's mythical, right? And here we are in a room where most everybody gets that. So when you start taking that knowledge about the recognition that a mobile phone is a PC, right? It's the most personal computer you could possibly own. I mean, this is a computer you keep so close to, you're afraid it's going to give you cancer. That's a pretty personal computer.
Yep.
So you've got this computer, you've got that one up in the sky, you know, we understand how those connections go together. Now apply that to all these problems. Like, you look at Silicon Valley, what is Silicon Valley really but people taking this latest concept in technology and disrupting existing industries with it, whether it's, you know, hotels with Airbnb and taxis with Uber. I mean, it's all the same model, really. Now let's apply that to disaster relief. You know, now that you recognize that, you know, as I studied, worked with NGOs and sort of talked about this thing, cell networks survive disasters surprisingly well. Yep. I mean, cell networks never work perfectly, but they never fully fail either. And they're actually a cornerstone to initial disaster response. So a funny thing about cell phones is you can find them, right? They already got antennas on them. So that first 24, 48 hours after disaster, you can use phones to locate people, because generally where you find a phone, you find a person. Mm-hmm. And so disaster response people are starting to leverage that to the point where even when the cell network is damaged, they'll come in with portable cell towers on trucks.
Yeah.
Drive them out. The arms go out, the mast goes up, instant cell tower running on a generator. And so the phone technology is wildly important, right? Whether it's in the hands of somebody who needs assistance or it's an assistance giver, it's an ability to facilitate moving faster. So one of the projects we got involved in very early on HTBox was a thing called the check-in service. This is not a wildly complex concept until you understand the overall ramifications of it. So for the disaster response worker, and they're mostly volunteers, they have an app on their phone that allows them to basically put in their information. I work for this NGO. I have this particular set of skills, which are a set of ISO standards. Just sort of all the info about who you are. Mm-hmm. So that when you arrive at a disaster site, so you take a big one, right? You take a typhoon or the Haiti earthquake or something like that. Literally hundreds of organizations descending on a location, all with the best of intention. Thousands of people are arriving. Now you have a relief coordinator. So this person is trying to figure out, who do I have on site? What skills do they have? Because, I mean, Doctors Without Borders, an amazing organization, and they have a portable hospital, they'll set up the things, but you need doctors in lots of different locations with other people. You need them with engineers and with search and rescue folks and so forth. So figuring out which doctors you've got and where the other teams are, it takes time. And I've seen this done. I've seen the walls of paper and whiteboards of people trying to organize this as quickly as possible. What if we could do it with software? What if when that person shows up with that app, that coordinator immediately has all of this information in front of them and is able to find them, assign them, you know, sort those teams out. And here's the most important part, the one you wouldn't think of. When that person leaves, when they've done their tour of duty, they don't always check out. So often you have a problem where we had this doctor who was helping us all that last week. Now I can't find him. Is he in danger? Or did he go home on one of the ships? We don't know. So the app helps us, as soon as it's out of the area, say, can I check you out?
Yeah.
Right? If you think of the feature list, I mean, again, we're all software people. It's not a huge, long feature list.
Yeah.
But when it's built to be resilient, to be low bandwidth, so it survives in conditions that aren't, you know, really sophisticated, uses the cloud so that we have access to all that data efficiently, it saves lives.
I definitely agree with you. Now, as software engineers, it's hard for us to know exactly what we can do to contribute. Like,
right.
You use the example of Doctors Without Borders. You use the example of a disaster, help software, however you want to term it. Now, we might not have expertise because, as you know, we tend to like to stay within the tech bubble.
Right?
Like, there's a bit of a bubble. What can we do to learn more about what other fields, other tools, what can we learn more, and how can we learn more so that we can do a contribution, so we can make a difference?
Well, and recognize everybody needs software. I mean, that's kind of, if you're willing to dedicate the time it takes, look, we've built software, you know what it takes, right? It's not a weekend thing, right? It's hundreds of hours of work, and a lot of that work is not writing code, right? This is making a plan, gathering requirements, actually figuring out what needs to be built. Then there's some construction, and then there's some testing and some evaluation. I mean, it's a lot of steps. And any individual developer could take on a project for a charity they care about, as long as they're prepared to commit the time. What we did with Humanitarian Toolbox is we took all of that other stuff off the table. We're doing the requirements gathering. We're planning through the project. We put everything up on GitHub so that anybody can contribute to it and anybody can use it. So we don't have to pick a winner, and you can come and go from a project. We're responsible for the organizational part, so you can pick up a work item and say, hey, well, I know how to build a C# service, And here's the specs for it. We write them out in pretty good detail. You want to pick it up and write it, contribute it back into us, we'll take your pull request.
That's awesome. If there's one thing that you need help with right now, what would it be?
So the project that is sort of at the forefront, if you go to htbox.org today, the main project you'll see is one called Already.
Yeah.
So let me tell you the Already story. I really like this project because it's preventative. An awful lot of what we do and deal with in disaster response is reactive. It's people are already in trouble, and we should help them. But what if we could decrease the impact of disaster? So Already came from a collaboration with the Red Cross. People may not know this, but the Red Cross has a huge group of volunteers, and these volunteers pretty much go out to every house fire that happens. And they show up as volunteers with some skills. They show up with blankets, they show up with teddy bears. If you've got a family out on the lawn watching their house burn,
yeah,
they need some help. And communities have their victim services and so forth, but the Red Cross is sort of a common denominator across all that. So where they see an opportunity to help, they will. It's not just blankets and teddy bears, too. It's the right set of phone numbers. It's what services are available, what can happen there. So the Red Cross is trying to put themselves out of that business by having house fires happen less often and less severe.
Yeah.
And the best way to do that is more smoke detectors. Again, not hard science. There's lots of smoke detectors around. Installing them properly takes some skill. And so they have skilled volunteers, often volunteer firefighters, that will install smoke detectors on the weekends. You just tell them where. Now, what can the cloud and mobile do for that problem,
mm-hmm,
right? You can organize this on paper with telephone calls, but it burns a lot of volunteer hours.
Yeah.
And volunteer hours are a precious resource. There's only so many of them. Let's do as much as we can with those hours. So the Already app is about organizing campaigns to get smoke detectors into homes, and then a mobile app so that the volunteer is able to get a list of phones based on their geographical location, locations that they can get to install those. So our goal is to be able to install that, use that volunteer's hours to get more smoke detectors installed in the same amount of time. But if you think about the app, how many other things could we apply that to?
It's
broad, right?
Yeah.
First aid training, right? We get if somebody's going to volunteer an afternoon to do first aid training, you do the campaign, let them know where they are, they can go there, right? There's all these mechanisms we could use to do this preventative work with this app. So this is our first use case, is the smoke detector case. Mm-hmm. And we've done this project actually started with a group of Microsoft developers. So this was part of the Studio 2015 launch. Mm-hmm. A group of guys in Redmond did the initial rev of the code. They got the prototype together as part of the 2015 launch.
Yeah.
And then that went to the Red Cross, and they worked with it for a while and came back with a whole bunch of feedback. And at HTBox, we ran a few hackathons up until one we just did after the MVP summit at the beginning of November to get the product to, I think, a minimal viable product. It is now being tested again by the Red Cross, trying to figure out, has it got all the right features? Are we ready to start putting it in the field? We're hoping by the end of this month, early December, to have the first field trials with it, which is going to, as everybody's had that experience, the first time you put the software in front of the users, they just kick the snot out of it, right? Like, now you find out. And so already we're getting this list of new work items to be picked up and continue to be worked on. So you want to help today, you can go to htbox.org. You'll see the Already project. It'll lead you to get a hub project. We are looking for designers. We're looking for web developers. We're looking for mobile developers. We're looking for testers. During that code-a-thon we did after the MVP summit, there was a bunch of developers. There's also a bunch of spouses who stuck around, and we handed them scripts, and they just hammered away on the software. In fact, they're not knowing the details and actually exercising the software. They found all kinds of things. It doesn't take a huge amount of skill to be able to exercise a piece of software and go, why does it work this way? This doesn't make sense to me, and we can make the software better as a consequence.
Interesting. You mentioned hackathons, and you've run a couple.
That is htbox.org. Now, we have humanitariantoolbox.org, but you have to be able to spell humanitarian. Okay. So we got the short one, too.
You mentioned hackathons. There's a couple out there that are all about doing good.
Yes.
Is there a resource that people can go to find out when the next hackathon is that could be useful?
I don't know of a centralized resource. Everybody's doing their own thing.
Yeah.
Out there. I mean, Twitter's a lot with those things.
Okay.
You know, there's a bunch of different ones. We're still learning the model It's very challenging to build software this way. I mean, people have good intention. The challenge is that, you know, every line of code has a price to it. Software's not really free, right? Software's free like a puppy's free, right? There's a price to that software. And so making sure you're making, and honestly, it's been really interesting on all the projects we've worked on to say, you have conscientious people, they'll actually hesitate to code until they have confidence that their code's not going to do harm, that it's not going to break the build. And so it's up to us to write great work items, good detail, so people understand what it's going to do, and to have good tests around it so you have confidence that what you contributed actually worked. And that's part of, I think, our responsibility, owning those projects, taking care of those projects, right, as curators of those projects, so that you have confidence you can contribute code that will actually make a difference in people's lives.
All right. Let's take questions from the audience. Anyone?
Yes. When it comes to the skill set of individual developers, we've worked really carefully to make sure that everybody can contribute by breaking the work down in detail. There are hard work items out there that you're going to need a certain amount of experience to do, but we have these easy to pick up items. We do need to correct spelling mistakes and correct formatting, and this thing needs to be reorganized. So some of those work items are simple to pick up, and so you'll see them tagged as that, right? They're good ways to get started, right? We want this to be a good first check-in experience. I really like this opportunity for people to get into the open source world in a way they may not have before, because an awful lot of open source can get, I'm the smartest guy in the room kind of thing, I can contribute to this project. We're not asking you to invent, right? I would like you to help us solve the problem, but we're going to outline the program in great detail for you so you can get a good look at the problem and take your time in it. There's lots of conversations going on. You're not expected to write code in the dark. In fact, I would hope you didn't. I would hope your first action when you go to the GitHub repository for Already or for any of our projects is to actually say, I would like to work on this, and ask a question, because there's folks out there working on this project as well who can help you understand where we really are. Most of our projects have a video associated with them, so you sort of see the vision of what we're working on. Typically, they're from the NGO folks themselves, right? They've been trying to get the software built for a long time. It's not easy to build software for folks that have never been in this space before. We just sort of take it for granted. All of us write code every day. Like, we're odd. Most other people just think it's kind of magic that goes on. And so that's true in the NGO world as well as it is in regular business, and they have the same set of problems. The challenge of managing the project is not a small one. We have project leaders. I mean, the reality of open source projects, especially we talk about in the Git universe where it's Linus Torvalds sort of started this whole thing, is there is a dictator for life, right? There's somebody who runs any given project. And somebody has to make the decision, is this code that will contribute to the project? We try to make it as clear as possible, but there's certainly cases where folks have run off in a direction that was inappropriate. That's why we hope you'll converse with us first. We don't guarantee we'll accept every pull request. We'd like to, but we have a larger mission in mind, right? There are folks out there that need to use this software, and so we have to be sure that we're moving the goal forward when we do that. If we have a problem with your code, we're going to tell you, right? We're not a mean bunch. Like, we're really trying to solve these things. We'd like you to work on it with us to get it to a good place. But in the end, there is a quality control bar here. We are trying to build software for regular mortal humans that are volunteering their time. And that it's a fairly substantial bar to pass. I've asked folks that have come out to our projects, like, why are you here? What's working for you? And some of them are just inspired. Lots of folks have always wanted to donate their skills. They're trying to find a way. You know, it's hard to be able to take your skills, but it's also an opportunity to exercise the skills in a different way. Typically, we're living in a pretty known box. You know, your organization probably has a set of tools they're using, a set of policies that they follow, and I don't have any problem with that. In fact, that's what good software looks like. This is a different box to live in. This is an opportunity to stretch your skills in a different way. So you can try some other things. We are often on the leading edge of technology. You know, already happens to be built with ASP.NET vNext and using EF7 and, you know, some pretty leading edge products. So, you know, a couple of the folks that were involved in the project saying, hey, you know, I'm nowhere near using this at work. I'd love a chance to exercise my skills so that I'm ready when work comes down the path. I've already done this. And it happens to be we're surrounded by some pretty senior ASP.NET people that can help you learn. You know, nobody's an expert in vNext yet, right? Okay. We're all learning it. Everybody that's worked on our project is learning it. So it is a space to learn in, but it's also a space to exercise that strength. You know, the more ways we think about coding, the better we get at it. So there is an opportunity there to stretch your brain in a different way and do some good while you're doing it. And it hopefully takes your career to a new level. Yep. So the technologies are being used in already. I talked about it's largely been C#. Obviously, the latest bits, the new version of ASP.NET with all the challenges that entails too. We've gone through several betas, although now we're in a release candidate, which is great. We're building the mobile clients with Cordova.
Interesting.
So because it covers the most number of phones. Yeah. I mean, if you think about it from a volunteer perspective, the most important thing is it works on your phone. And we don't want to write a custom client for every phone. We have a great mobile web app that's come together on that, but we're still building the actual mobile apps specific for the device. So Cordova seems like a good choice. It's not just going to be iPhones out there, right? I mean, especially when you talk about the non-technical audience that are the folks that would be installing smoke detectors, they're just as likely to have a BlackBerry. You know, and we want the app to work there too. And Cordova picks that up for us. But that means that's a JavaScript set. It's a JavaScript, HTML5. You know, I think the initial framework around that client looks like it's going to be a spa app, just because that gives you the best sort of feel for a mobile device. But making that work across all the platforms, that's an interesting challenge. Now, I think one of the biggest things is you are talking about traveling neighborhood to neighborhood. And so connectivity is going to be a challenge. So the more I can buffer in the device, and a standalone app is more robust for that kind of problem. It's challenging to make a true web app function when the connectivity is down. So that's been we built the web app first, and I firmly believe in that because that'll work for a lot of cases. But then there is a need, we can see a need, and the Red Cross has expressed a need for something that's going to be more robust. So we're also moving towards mobile apps as well. We're trying. I'd love, if you know how to do that, I want to talk to you. Because I got some work items I can push over your way. And that's only one of our projects. Okay, I mean, already is the sort of marquee project to Azure at the moment, and it's getting to a good place. We've looked at pure native apps, mobile apps for some of the other products we've worked on. Again, some of this has to do with skill set. We had a group of great iPhone developers show up at one of our codethons one time and cranked out an app for check-in. Like it's a pretty powerful experience when it depends on the skills you have. We have need for everything, just of what items can be picked up and how far can we take with them.
If there's one thing that you learned from running this organization, what would it be?
It is not in your best interest to do all that stuff yourself.
Okay.
So it's been one of the challenges for me personally has been resisting getting buried in the individual projects, right? I have to value the volunteers that I have for the volunteer skills and make sure I'm doing the other things, even though they're not necessarily the fun things. So, you know, we do get great volunteer development resources and great leadership resources too. And so I've been really excited about that. I go work on the other things. You know, this is about valuing the differences in that space. And so you got to sort of perceive the holes. We're full of good tech people. We're not full of good charity people. So I'm still learning the rules of how to operate a charity and how to interact with the disaster response folks. Like, those are all interesting, challenging problems too. So you can't always lean on what you know best. You know, for me, that's been a really interesting experience. I have a team of folks, and they're all working on that thing. That's the thing I can't work on.
Okay.
I have to go work on one of the other things. If that's being done well, something else is being left behind. Let's go make sure we get those other things picked up, too.
If there's one last piece of advice that you'd give to developers that want to get involved, what would it be?
Communicate first.
Communicate first.
Yeah. There's lots of places. I hope you'll participate in HD Box. We could use your help. There are lots of charitable organizations out there and opportunities, but you should lead with a conversation. Make sure you know what's happening, what's going on. And they'll ask you. We'll ask for help. We need help.
That's awesome. All right, well, that's all we've got for time right now. Thank you so much, Richard, for coming to speak with us.
My pleasure, Remy.
Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.